Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Jones, Bowden, he's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket with me, Simon Hughes.
And me, Simon Mann.
Now, a few weeks ago, we lamented the passing of one of Gloucestershire, your county's favourite sons, Simon, Mike Proctor, who passed away a couple of weeks ago. And today we heard the sad news of the passing of one of England's greatest ever cricketers, and arguably their greatest ever spinner, Derek Underwood, Deadly, as he was known, who really was Deadly. He was an absolutely brilliant left-arm spinner and wonderful character, who I knew pretty well, actually, and played against. And it feels like part of my childhood has gone, actually, because I used to watch him play for Kent in the 1970s and 80s.
Yeah, I watched a lot of him. In the 1970s, he was sort of part of my formative years of watching cricket. And you know, there was the legend, Deadly. If you played on an uncovered pitch, as they did in those days, and it rained, and then you went off the field, came back on, Derek Underwood was bowling, you almost, it felt, had no chance as a batting side. He would just run straight through. He was the sort of greatest exponent, wasn't he, of bowling on a uncovered pitch that had taken rain. He was so difficult to face. Caught not bowled Underwood, you know, they went together. Alan Knott, brilliant wicketkeeper. Derek Underwood, a brilliant bowler. England's most successful spinner in terms of test match wickets, and 2,500 wickets, 2,500 first class wickets at 20. A fantastic bowler. And well, you saw a lot of him, yours, and you also played against him.
He was one of the first bowlers I watched, actually, in the late 60s, playing for Kent and got an early chance for England. He made his debut for Kent, actually, when he was 18. And funnily enough, he's in a way, he's a symbol of the fact that cricket appeals to all types, and all types of athletic or non-athletic bodies can succeed, because Derek Underwood was not a particularly athletic character. In fact, he had very flat feet. You might remember from old footage when he ran up to bowl, he looked as if he was sort of waddling almost with flippers on. But he, although he wasn't a great athlete, he converted himself into a very fine left-arm spinner. He started as a medium pacer, actually, but then converted to left-arm spin. And I think part of the reason why he was so good was because he was a former medium pacer. So he bowled at a rapid rate, a bit like Anil Kumble did for India many years later, who also started as a medium pacer. And he was able to ally that speed of arm with a clever change of pace and obviously able to turn the ball. But I suppose his hallmark was his accuracy. He was phenomenally accurate. He never wavered from that spot just outside the off stump or on the off stump to the right-handers. And I remember actually watching him bowl and being mesmerised by the way how accurate he was, and then thinking, God, I hope I never face him. And I did face him in one of my first-class matches. And obviously I wasn't a very good batsman. I thought, well, I don't know how I'm going to deal with it. And it was a turning pitch at Canterbury as well. So he was someone who was had an extra ingredient there at his disposal. And I just thought, well, what I've got to look out for is his quicker ball. Because so often he would bowl an over and bowl an over of sort of reasonably slow deliveries and then fire in his incredible quicker ball, which just caught everyone by surprise and knocked them over. And so I thought, right, when I face him, I know about his quicker ball. I've seen it get so many wickets. I'm just going to make sure I resist that. And there was about four men round the bat in a championship game as I came into bat. But I'm sure there were Kent players saying, who's this Muppet? And all I tried to do was look out for the quicker ball. So I thrust my bat and pad towards the line of each delivery, thinking it was the quicker ball, and it was slower and slower. So I ended up playing far too early and punching the ball with my gloves over the top of the close fielders, the ball sort of ballooning up in all directions because I was so determined to stop the quicker ball and he was bowling slower and slower. Very embarrassing. But it showed the skill of his art because I couldn't tell that it was slower. You know, and then he fired in the quicker one, and of course that got me out. So, you know, obviously I wasn't one of his most important wickets, but it was indicative there of his skill, of his deception, and his phenomenal accuracy. And the other lovely thing about him, actually, was he would say, oh, bad luck, matey, afterwards, if he got you out. He was a cheerful chap who sort of almost wished you goodbye and see you in the bar later sort of thing. And he was like that. He was genial all his life. And so, you know, just the most wonderful personality and the most fantastic bowler.
Yeah, I suppose my memories of him, you know, would have been mainly of watching him on television. I remember a test match in 1974, England against Pakistan at Lord's, where it did rain and Pakistan were batting and uncovered pitch, came out after the rain, drying out a bit. He took 5 for 20 and 8 for 51. And, you know, that was what you knew he was going to do when you handed him the ball. A couple of years later, of course, he played against that West Indies side, Viv Richards making that fantastic double hundred at the Oval, and that was some hard toil for him, 303 for 165 in 60.5 overs. But also that great photograph. So, you know, people talk about iconic photographs, don't they? That photograph where he's both feet off the ground against a fast ball, a short pitch ball from Michael Holding. And it really did sum up what it was like to go up against those West Indies fast balls, especially on that Old Trafford pitch that was very spicy. And of course, that was a test match of Close and Edrich facing that barrage on the Saturday night when someone from the crowd brought out that huge bat for John Edrich. And Brian Close had all those bruises on his body, which he refused to rub. But you know, earlier in the game, Derek Underwood, both feet off the ground, bouncer, you know, whistling past his head.
Yeah, I mean, his body jackknifed to avoid that. And of course, there were no helmets in those days. I suppose, really, his finest hour may have been, or certainly one that you can go back and watch on YouTube, is the famous day at the Oval in 1968, where England were 2-1 down in the Ashes. It was the last day of the series, and it rained heavily at the Oval. Famously, a lot of people in the crowd, waiting, hopefully, for some play, came out and helped dry up the ground with mops and flannels and towels and stuff. And England managed to get the play underway with about an hour left for play and sort of 8 wickets to get. And Underwood was absolutely in his element there, as you say, on a drying pitch, which had got wet first. And he just, again, was mesmerising and finally got the wicket of John Inverarity to tie up the victory and the series almost 5 minutes from the close of play. So a memorable day for Derek Underwood, a long time ago, of course, now. He was just a wonderful figurehead for the game, someone who made the most of his ability and was internally modest and just always cheerful and welcoming, and he'll be much missed.
How many wickets would he have got with DRS now? Would that have made a huge difference? I suppose some people might say, what if he'd not bowled on uncovered pitches? You know, bowlers these days have to bowl on, you know, pitches that aren't affected by rain.
Yeah, a good question. And I think he took 8% of his wickets LBW, which of course is very low compared to the modern spinners who are taking their LBWs at sort of 25% of their wickets are LBW, like Graham Swan or somebody like that, or even more recently. And he only took 8% of his wickets because so often umpires would give it not out if the batsman was forward. I think he was unlucky, actually, because he was so accurate. And I'm sure many of his deliveries were hitting the pad and going on to hit the stumps, but umpires voted in the batsman's favour. So probably, certainly in Test cricket, he finished on 297, I think, didn't he? If he'd played in this era, it would have been 500 for sure.
Mm. Well, he would have been one of those players. I mean, this era, he'd have been that bowler. That, I mean, you'd carry around him the whole time, wouldn't you? He'd have been there in your squad every single match.
Yeah, he would, and he would have always been cheerful in the dressing room and positive all the time. He made the most of his ability with the bat, which was negligible, but I think he got a first-class 100 in the end. So that showed how hard he worked at his batting and his fielding. He wasn't a natural athlete, but he made himself into a solid and dependable fielder. So he just was the ultimate team man. And England were the lesser when he retired. So were Kent, of course, for whom he played for 30 years, nearly 30 years, three decades. And he was the lifeblood of that Kent team for many years.
You are right, Yoz. He made one first-class 100, he made 111, and he made two half-centuries. But it is for his wonderful left-arm, I'm going to say, sort of medium-pace spin that people will... I remember him. He was one of England's greatest cricketers.
So I wonder what he would have made of bowling on some of these early season pitches with the Kookaburra ball. It hasn't been to the relish of too many bowlers with the extraordinary scores we've seen round the country. Just continuing the Kent theme, by the way, coming up, we have an interview with Rob Key, which I did on Saturday night at a lovely village club in Kent, Bearsted Cricket Club, which was celebrating its 275th anniversary. And Rob Key was the guest of honour. And we talked about a lot of different subjects, one of which was this.
I think whatever you do, life is so much more interesting when you change. You know, like there's, you sort of, you do something. And I, as I say, I love that Sky job. But this is something new and you're learning a new skill. You know, and you do this for a little bit and then you do something else. I think, you know, I'm very lucky in that regard. I played cricket for a long time. Then I learned a brand new skill as a broadcaster. And then I think experience is such an overrated thing because, you know, like when you're hiring people for jobs, they always go, well, have they done a version of that job? And you think, so what? You know, like, you know, that experience can be a negative reason for why they don't get it. If someone's done a job for a long time and only been average at it, well, why would you hire them? You know, I'd much rather take a punt on people. And that's what I was lucky Straussie sort of thought with me.
So more from Rob Key a little bit later. But, of course, we should just consider the round of county championship matches which have just concluded with, Simon, no positive results. A sequence of draws.
The sequence of draws, to some extent, that's because of the weather on the final day. Some matches were delayed at the start, some rain around, knocked out first sessions, but also some, you know, flat pitches and the Kookaburra ball. The bowlers will be cursing it. They'll want to go, I don't know, go and find the supply and lock them up or throw them in the river or something and get rid of them because it's been really hard work. I mean, some massive scores around the country. I mean, you'll know it, of course, as you've been following the games, everybody listening. But you know, things to pick out. Durham scoring 517, but following on. Sussex making nearly 700. Northampton Middlesex in their game, a couple of 550s each. A whole host of double hundreds around. George Bell run out for 99. And a great escape from Gloucestershire against Yorkshire. Four down overnight. And it didn't rain in Bristol. It was a full day's play. But Gloucestershire finishing on 405 for six to deny Yorkshire a first win of the season. So, I mean, I think that just about sums it up. Oh, no, one other thing to mention, of course, talking about spinners and Derek Underwood. Actually, at the Oval, 12 Somerset wickets to spin. And we all saw the pitches at the Oval last season where Surrey would basically use four or five pace bowlers and you know, they were impossible to overcome. In fact, they overcame the opposition more often than not. But in that match, okay, there was a bit of rain around in London this morning, and that probably just thwarted them, and they went for a sort of dash to score 219 overs and couldn't get there. But, yeah, 12 wickets to spin, 9 wickets to Cam Steele, and Dan Lawrence picking up some wickets. He actually opened the bowling in the second innings as well. So what are we to make of it? And the Kookaburra ball, Yoz, the reason it's been brought in is because England do not do very well in Australia, and they sort of, where you have to play with the Kookaburra ball, and you need to make the most of it, learn to bowl with it. But, well, it seems as if there are a lot of bowlers who are struggling with it.
Well, I've got a Kookaburra ball here, actually. I'm at the newly named Utilita Bowl, formerly the Rose Bowl, the Aegeus Bowl, Hampshire. I've been watching Hampshire against Lancashire today, and Nathan Lyon tried his best to take wickets. So did a few seam bowlers, but they couldn't part the Hampshire fifth wicket pair, and it obviously ended in a draw. And I just, looking at this ball, I picked up a ball from the practice this morning, a Kookaburra. It's just rubbish. This is about 50 overs old, and it's got no seam left on it at all. The seam, in fact, is frayed, so it's almost coming apart. It's totally flat. There's no hardness to the ball. You can't shine it. So they've tried their best to shine it, but it's only got sort of mottled shine, sort of rather matte sort of looking appearance. And it's just absolutely terrible to bowl with. It just feels soft and like you wouldn't give it to your dog, practically. I mean, and it's only about 50 overs old. It's an apology of a ball for me, especially in flat English conditions. So it's good riddance to it, in my view, and they're not using it again until the end of the season. I spoke to Mohammed Abbas, actually, the fine bowler for Hampshire and Pakistan, and he just said, I can't wait for the Duke to come back, because this is it's a fruitless exercise trying to get wickets with the Kookaburra.
But when England go to Australia, they will have to bowl with the Kookaburra ball, won't they? And so is it worth it to show bowlers here what they will have to come up against when they go to Australia, or is it just sort of ruining the start of the county championship?
I don't think it's worth it. And anyway, it's only for 2 games. What's the point? You're not going to learn much in 2 games, really. So, no. The only thing we've learned is that it makes a flat pitch even flatter. So I think it was a mistake doing it. By the way, I'm down here in Hampshire partly to cover the match, but also to try a new camera system to try and upgrade the level of the quality of the streams that we've been enjoying over the last few years since COVID. And we've installed here at Hampshire 6 remote operated cameras. So they're fixed cameras that haven't got a cameraman, and they're trained on different angles on the pitch or on the outfield. And it's been a success, actually. The locals have enjoyed it. We've cut between the cameras. We brought in one manned camera as well, so the manned camera could follow the ball, but the other cameras were cut to show different incidents and runouts and obviously shots and stuff. And actually, it made the coverage look very professional. It looked like a quality sort of Sky type broadcast. So very pleased with the experiment. I mean, the idea behind it is, in the end, to get more viewers and enable counties to commercialise the streams, because at the moment they don't earn anything for them from those streams at all. They go straight onto YouTube. YouTube take most of the advertising revenue, and the counties get nothing. And a lot of thousands, even millions of people are now tuning into those streams over a season. So there is some potential money to be made there, but the coverage needs to be better. And we're trying to create a sort of affordable version of high-class broadcasts.
So when are we going to see this in operation again? Is it a one-off experiment, or is it going to continue with Hampshire this season?
We're hoping to continue with Hampshire for the whole season. We're certainly booked in again for the second match here at the Utilita Bowl next Friday. It's against Warwickshire. So check the Hampshire stream next week and have a look at it. There was an article actually about this streaming business in the Sunday Times yesterday, mentioning our experiment and saying that in the end we're hoping to bring in artificial intelligence to help follow the ball, which again is a cost-saving exercise. For me, it's been quite interesting because I've sort of half worked on the commentary and half tried to work on the production and getting a director to cut the pictures and moving the cameras around. I've now got a carload of equipment. I've never been the roadie before, but I've been lucky that, you know, we've had other people to do that. But today I've been loading all the camera boxes and cables and tripods into my car. I just hope I make it back to London.
Well, good luck with that. Before you go, Jos, we should hear from Rob Key, shouldn't we? And lots of interesting things that Rob Key says are well worth staying with it. Just explain again the background to the interview.
Yeah, well, it was a chap who approached me a few months ago and said, Bearsted Cricket Club, it's our 275th anniversary and we're having a big dinner. So that means the club was founded in 1749. Amazing, really, isn't it? Fantastic. And it's very much Kent and Sussex are very much the birth of cricket. That's where the Shepherds first played the game with a crook and two sticks in the ground and probably a ball of wool as the ball. And this ground, it's a little village green in the middle of Kent, in the heart of Kent, a wonderful spot. And they staged this dinner and they said to me, could I bring a sort of Kentish themed special guest? I asked Rob if he would do it. He said he would. He was very willing. And so we sat up on stage and chatted about life and cricket and selection and Brendan McCullum and Harry Brook and many things. And I started by asking him about perhaps the most unusual aspect of his playing career, which was that his best friend in cricket was none other than Freddie Flintoff, Andrew Flintoff. It's a very odd pairing, but they were absolutely inseparable. And I asked him why they got together.
We met, I reckon, in England, for England under-19s, when we were both he's a year older than me, so he would have been 18, I would have been 17, or something like that. And we played at Edgbaston, and like most of these things, you sort of become friends on a night out rather than anything else. And from that, you meet people that, you know, you just click with straight away. He was one of those for me. You know, as much as you meet people you don't like straight away, you can probably bet they don't like you as well. But, yeah, we ended up playing with and against each other for a long time. We still speak most of the time now. He's now getting involved in coaching, which is brilliant because he'll be an excellent coach. But I always remember, and the other great friend of ours, which was slightly bizarre, but this is what county cricket gave you back then, not so much now. You used to have overseas players, and they were some of the best in the world. So we had Raul Dravid, Carl Hooper. Carl Hooper was so much better than the rest of us. Like, he batted in a floppy cap half the time, and he batted without a thigh pad. He used to run down and hit spinners into the, like, miles back. Played Wasim Akram once, got a double hundred, and just kept chipping the ball for six. You know, but then Muralitharan came and played for us. The first time he turned up on an away trip, he'd washed his blue kit with his white kit, so he's bowling in silver whites. He got 6 for 12 or something. He was an absolute genius. And he turned up the first net practice and he put a ball down on one of his lengths for an off spinner and one length for a doosra. And he ran up, and I reckon it was 9 out of 10. He just went... And he'd hit a ball. He'd go off spinner and he'd hit the ball there. If you imagine how hard that is. We did a masterclass with him, which you can see on YouTube, and he still hit that ball now, even though he's been retired. And Freddie tells a story of they were great mates. And when they're playing England versus Sri Lanka, I'm actually not playing in this game. And Freddie and Murali playing for England and Sri Lanka, they had a deal. And that was, Murali said, if you don't bowl bouncers at me, I won't bowl doosras at you. Which was a much better deal for Fred because he couldn't pick Murali. And Murali was batting like number 11, but he generally, you speak to Sangakkara, because Fred was his friend, he'd never spin the ball both ways. He'd only ever spin it one way. And then one of these games, Nasser sort of has had enough of Murali just bowling England out, being a pain. So he says to Fred, right, nobody talk to him. And when he comes into bat, just try and hit him so he doesn't bowl at us. So in the meantime, because they were such good friends, and Fred's not allowed to talk to Murali during the matches, but they had the same bat sponsor. So Murali has asked to borrow Fred's bat, and Fred's thinking, well, hang on, don't let Nasser know that I've lent you his bat or my bat. He's like, don't worry, I won't say a thing. I won't do his accent. So he's like, whatever you do, don't tell Nasser that you're borrowing my bat. So anyway, Murali comes out to bat, and Nasser says to him, right, come on in, bowl him some bouncers. But Fred's got the deal where if I bowl him a bouncer, he's going to start spinning it both ways. So he turns around. So Nasser sort of runs in, first ball, and bowls him a slower ball. And Murali smacks him for four. And Nasser's like abusing Fred. Come on, you've got to bowl short at him. Make sure you hit him. So Fred's like, okay. So he runs in, bowls him another length ball, and Murali slogs it again, and it goes for four. And he turns around to Fred with Nasser watching and just holds his bat up and says, good bat, Freddie.
Brilliant. I mean, yeah, the bizarre friendship that you find in cricket, isn't it? That's a great example, actually. I mean, Jimmy and Brodie, I've always found, and Jimmy and Swanee as well. Jimmy Anderson and Graham Swann, what a bizarre pair they were. I don't know if anybody here watched that. They did a whole video sequence in the Ashes of the year that England won the Ashes in Australia, 2010-11. They did a whole load of sort of silly videos, and there was one where Jimmy dressed up as a woman and sort of suddenly appears in the hotel bedroom, in Swanee's hotel bedroom. And it was a very clever kind of use of social media, actually. So Freddie, well, it's great to hear him back, actually. And I think you were sort of partly instrumental in he returned for the first time during the Ashes, at the end of the Ashes, didn't he, last summer? He was out there at the Oval. I mean, what's that been like, that relationship with him? It must have been difficult over the last couple of years.
Yeah, so Freddie was obviously in a bad crash with Top Gear. Probably worse than people realised. And I reckon, when was it? Just in the first lockdown, I had a small stroke. I was very lucky. And the worst thing with all of that is it's not the actual thing. It's after it, when you've just got so much anxiety and you walk around and think, geez, what's going to happen here? And Fred was the same a little bit, where all he was doing was sitting in a room, watching TV, he watched Holmes Under the Hammer and Loose Women and all that, you know, just watching daytime TV all the time. And I said to him, well, you need to get out. Come and watch the cricket. I always watch, because I don't like sitting in the boxes. You know, I can't do with the hobnobbing and, you know, chatting away to people, because it's like, you know, it's my job now. And it's stressful watching it. You know, every time there's a wicket and someone goes, oh, that was crap. And you think, yeah, thanks for that. You know, and you just sort of like, I could do without anyone talking to me like that. So I just sit in a back office at Lord's, or we get the CEOs give you an office to watch from. And I just said, come and watch all the time. And he sort of came, the first time he came at Lord's, when we played Ireland, and you could tell he's got a bit of scarring and, you know, like he was anxious, as you are. Mm. But then gradually he got better and better, and then he ended up coaching for us in the one days. And what I love, and this is the point I was making earlier, the best thing about it was that sort of for all the things he's done, like Top Gear and A League of Their Own, and, you know, God, he's like hosted, he sang and did a sung in a musical. I mean, like, sang with him in a musical with Curly from Coronation Street and someone off The X Factor. It's like, what's your life come to, mate? But the thing was that cricket was the thing that got him back. You know, the thing that really got him back feeling better and getting back to normal life was cricket and the people in cricket. And that's what I'm talking about. That's why it's such a good thing. You know, you'll remember people here, you know, not maybe this night, but you'll have friends here for life because of it. And that's what, you know, it's no different in professional cricket. And you have as many, you know, you have a lot of people you don't like, but that's part of it.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
What persuaded you to do that job? And now, of course, he's the director of England cricket now. You're the big man. You're the head honcho. What persuaded you to do that? You had a cushy job with Sky. And the great thing about commentary, which I don't think anybody sort of, you know, there's lots of people who were tipped for that job, like Michael Vaughan and Michael Atherton and Nasser Hussain and people like that. Because none of them agreed to do it. They all prefer that cushy life, armchair critic, you know, no responsibility. You can say what the hell you like. As long as you get your paycheck from Sky or whoever, you're fine next year. It's not the case for him. You know, it's a meritocracy, what he's doing now. And you did give up a nice life, and you were very good at it as well. I mean, I think he was one of the most interesting people on TV, actually. There's no ego there as well, which is quite nice to see, actually, because most people in TV have massive egos. But he didn't let the ego get in the way of saying interesting things. So why did you take it on?
I don't know the answer to that. I think that you're right. Sky was a brilliant job and I loved every second of it. And I was doing a vodcast after England had lost the Ashes. And we're doing what we did. You sort of trade backwards. You England do well, you say they're great. England do badly, you say they're rubbish. And you think of reasons why. And there's no like, and you have a few views and you think, oh, do you know what, if they did this, like everyone, you sit around, we were talking this evening, it's like so-and-so's a good player and so-and-so can't play, you know, and everyone's got an opinion, but you don't really get to see if it's any good. And I think the thought of, you know, of being able to test that out and have some skin in the game, I said, was why I went for it. And there's a, you know, I think life is more, I think whatever you do, life is so much more interesting when you change. You know, like there's, you sort of, you do something, and I, as I say, I love that Sky job. But this is something new, and you're learning a new skill. You know, and you do this for a little bit, and then you do something else. I think, you know, I'm very lucky in that regard. I played cricket for a long time. Then I was learned a brand new skill as a broadcaster. And then I think experience is such an overrated thing because, you know, like when you're hiring people for jobs, they always go, well, have they done a version of that job? And you think, so what? You know, like, you know, that experience can be a negative reason for why they don't get it. If someone's done a job for a long time and only been average at it, well, why would you hire them? You know, I'd much rather take a punt on people. And that's what I was lucky Straussy sort of thought with me. And it's been great fun. I went into Lords the first day. I didn't have a clue what was going on. You know, everyone here's probably had a proper job. This is the first proper job I've ever had. You know, I've got like I've got the head of HR telling me about, like, I don't know, org charts and I don't know what any of this stuff is, you know. But what I knew was that I had a view on what English cricket needed to do, and that if I asked for help, I was sure that people would give it to me. You know, and I always thought as a captain, and not everyone does this, your main job is to hire better people around you. You know, what really bad leaders do is they hire rubbish people who aren't threatening beneath them. And actually, your job becomes really hard then because you end up having to do their job. And I was lucky. I had a brilliant performance director, had brilliant talent ID people, had brilliant science and medicine people, brilliant physios, all of that. And they, you know, you just got to give them the vision and the belief that they can do things. So that's, you know, how I sort of keep blagging my way through it.
Actually, I love the way you talk about the game, and I just like the spirit that you purvey as a squad, because it's the ethos in a way. I mean, we're not talking about basketball, but we're going to talk about the ethos of the England team. Is it really, obviously you want to win, but is it really about entertainment, which I always felt was the most important thing when I was a player?
Yeah, part of it. I think that the main thing in my view is that the mentality of English cricket, we needed to change it, right? Like and this is a little bit with our culture, I think, is that, I don't know, you'd have people that do this where they just see the downside. They see the threat in everything. You know, so like you say to your friends, or I say to my wife sometimes, like just say, like, you fancy going for dinner? And the first thing she'll do is point out three reasons why not. You know, like, well, what about the dogs, the traffic? And I'm thinking, look, I know all of that, you know. See the opportunity in life. And, you know, when we're in cricketing terms, what we would do is, like, you'd get out and you'd be like, yeah, don't do that. You know, if you've got a coach or captain who turns around to you every time you get out and go, yeah, you shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have played outside your eyes and nicked it. You go, yeah, thanks for that. You know, and then the next time you go out, you're thinking, don't do that. Don't do that. And that's what we did. You know, like England lost an Ashes test at Adelaide, and they put videos of them all getting out with playing away from their body and saying, should have left that, should have left that. You go, yeah, thanks for that. And then that has a knock-on effect to the next game. And then the next game, it's like, so you've got to be, it's like a, the mentality has to change. You know, so you go out there and when you're batting, you look to score. Your brain's got to work as fast as anything because the ball's coming down at 90 mile an hour sometimes. So you can't, if you're thinking of surviving, you're like this, you're sort of, your brain's not working fast enough to make quick decisions. But if you're thinking, right, here we go, I'm going to look to score here, you know, and you pick your bat up and you look to hit the ball, you've got more chance of, you've got three options. You might score runs, you might survive, or you might get out. That's a much better position than if you look to survive and just look to hang in there. You got two options. You hang in there or you get out. It's like if you want to bat, people say, you know, bat time equals runs. No, no. If you score runs, you can, if you're scoring runs, you can bat for longer. And that's the philosophy. So and then it's very simple. They talk about Brendan McCullum and Ben, who are great leaders. They spoke for about 3 minutes each the first day. And they sort of changed the mentality a little bit because what they did was say, right, I want people, Brendan's very quietly spoken and he said, I want you to, you know, look to put bowlers under pressure when you bat. I want you to be able to soak it up at the right time. I want you to look to take wickets, which is not always what people do, you know, like half the time it's like, oh, we're going to stop people scoring. We're going to bowl dry.
Build again, pressure, you know.
Build pressure.
Yeah.
But you can do that by looking every time. You've always got to see the upside, you know, see the opportunity. Look to take a wicket every ball. And the same thing, chase every ball hard in the field. And Jack Leach, if you remember the first test, Jack Leach and Zach Crawley spent the whole night watching videos on YouTube of Brendan McCullum chasing the ball hard to the boundary. And then Leachy chased it so hard to the boundary, he tripped up and gave himself concussion. But they did. And then he said, like, and don't do anything that puts you on the front page of the Herald. Now, none of them really knew what that meant. But, you know, like in New Zealand, obviously, that's the equivalent of the Sun, probably. And that was it. And Ben spoke about, I want you to feel loose under my captaincy. I want you to feel like when you're not gripping the bat too tight, that feeling when you're really confident and you're just, you know, you're waving your bat. You see Root and Stokes when they're playing really well. There's that rhythm to their batting. But the really smart thing that they do is that you can't, now everyone will say, like, go out there and be fearless, you know, play without fear. That's not the secret. Like, everyone can say that. Mm. But then every time you speak, you've got to reiterate that. And what Brendan and Ben are very clever at, so they'll say in India, because they'd say to the openers who have done really well, they'd be like, no, don't be afraid to hit a few sixes today. What they're not saying is like, go and hit sixes. They're just giving them that option. So they're sort of saying it's okay to fail doing something positive. Getting out is getting out. If you get out playing a big shot or you get out blocking one, it doesn't matter. You know, and that's the key. I played a test match once and Duncan Fletcher was a brilliant coach, very clever. And he said to me once, like, Keezy, you know, you're good at this shot through the offside. Don't whip across it. And I remember getting out to a ball against the West Indies and I whipped across it, but I thought it decked. And I went in and said, oh, no, I've got out doing what he said. I'm going to be in even more trouble. And then I thought, what are you doing? You're weak. You know, like, you're now, you know, you're worrying about the way you're getting out because of what a coach has said. So you try and take away all of that stuff. And that's like that's what I see as this Baz ball, which we hate because I said to Brendan, I can't remember, Andrew Miller, I think, came up with it.
Yeah.
And we're going, what is this Baz ball they keep talking about? And what about Stokes ball or something like that? And I said, you watch, when we lose, we'll have to defend the thing we haven't even come up with, you know, and sure enough, there we are, you know, is Baz ball working? Well, don't even do it, you know, like, what are you talking about?
That was fascinating to listen to. Brendan McCullum said to me in 2015, out on the field before a test match against England, New Zealand, England, he was captain of New Zealand at the time, just before England's reinvention as a one-day side. And I was talking to him about, you know, cricket generally. And I said, go on, what's your ethos? And he said, I try and tell my players, this is Kiwis, I try and tell my players to imagine they're an 11-year-old boy and they're about to play cricket today. It's a Saturday morning and you're going to be playing cricket. and they've woken up in their bed and they've opened the curtains and it's a lovely sunny day. And I want to inject that idea of fun and enjoyment and excitement in my players. And thinking about, you know, as if they're an 11-year-old boy. And I think he's tried to sort of convey that to England. But what, so what actually identified him to you? Why did you choose him as the coach? And why did you choose Stokes as the captain?
Brendan was quite simple, really. So I knew that I had a chance of this job. And I was thinking about who the coach could be. And I knew Brendan a little bit, not that well. But I felt that what he'd done with New Zealand is what we needed, you know. He'd got them playing fearless cricket. And so many people, before I took the job on, everyone was talking about, whenever we fail in England, right, whenever we do something that isn't good, someone will go, right, we've got to fight now, you know, get stuck in. You know, let's not give, you know, and it's like this British bulldog spirit and all this rubbish, you know, like, it's not, sometimes you can try too hard. You know, when you go out to bat or you bowl, cricket's not a game. The harder you try, the better it gets. You know, and I felt we needed someone to take the pressure off players and get them being more aggressive. You know, because that's a better way to play. You know, your brain works faster when you're thinking more positively, when you're looking to be more aggressive. So I wanted someone who can do that. And when I interviewed Brendan, I loved the, you know, the first time I've worn a tie for like 2 or 3 years. I always love people like, it's not like what you see is what you get. Like, he was wearing a cap in his we did loads of interviews. He's wearing a cap. He's in India. He's, you know, probably in like a hoodie. You know, he's not turning up in a suit and all this stuff. It's like, who cares what you wear? You know, like, what are you saying? And so we just sort of, everything that I thought, he thought as well. You know, he had just a lot more credibility than me. So it's very simple, that. And when he speaks, you're just like, yeah, no, you get it. It's like when we watch this Bashir bowl, when we pick this Bashir, you sort of watch three balls and you go, well, he can bowl. Like, it's not, doesn't, you don't have to take forever to make a decision, you know, just make it.
Or look at the data.
Yeah, or look at all the data and all of that. You just get a feel and you go, well, we'll go with that. You know, what's the worst that can happen? And then Stokes, he had one. So Ben Stokes, I knew a little bit. And because I knew a few of the players. If you remember, there was a COVID series when they had to play a second team, and Stokes was captain because he'd been resting or something from the series. So he captained the white ball series then, when O'Morgan was still around, I think. And England won that easily. And there was an innings in where Pakistan sort of batted for 310, but they played quite a reserved nature. Of reserve way, and England got it easy. They chased down the runs in with five overs to go. Some, I can't remember exactly, but they did it easy. And Stokes said to all of them, he said, any of you bat like they did, you'll never play in a team that I play, that I'm captain of. And I thought, that's such clarity. And that's what I felt England needed. They needed someone who was prepared to get on the front foot, you know, go out there. And you know, you got Harry Brook and Johnny Bairstow, Zach Crawley, Ollie Pope, Ben Duckett, you know, all these guys, they're so talented. We've got so many talented players in England. You just don't want them playing with handcuffs, worrying about the danger, you know, like, you know, go over there, this will happen. So I don't want, you know, I think we catastrophize everything. So every decision is either like the best thing in the world or the worst thing. That's never true. Generally, it sort of ends up in the middle. It's like, you know, should we go out for that dinner? Oh, it's going to be unbelievable. Or it's going to be rubbish. No, it'll be all right. You know, do you know what I mean? So it's a cultural mentality, I think, that we wanted to try and just see the upside with it.
This current job, does it keep you awake at night? And if so, what keeps you awake? Or are you still a very good sleeper?
No, I was never a great sleeper. I'd sort of, like most people, no matter what I was doing, I'd sort of be knackered watching telly, go upstairs and then be wide awake, which was bloody annoying. But that's, you know, often I'm always thinking about it all the time, where, you know, like, I'm always playing arguments I'm going to have with people. I don't know if you do that, where I'm sort of thinking, right, they might say this and then I'm going to say that and then I'll do this and bang and then I'll win that argument. You know, like, you just... They're the things that I think about, but I've always done that. I've never, you know, I've been terrible at getting to sleep, but then awful at waking up. But I love it. It's great fun. You know, like it was all going so well. And then we obviously had this winter where we lost. We were awful in the World Cup. And then I thought actually in India, we competed and we had so many opportunities that we didn't take. You know, and we were so close. But in the end, you know, we lost 4-1. But that, you know, feels like we're 2 years into this now, myself, Brendan, Ben. And it feels like a good time now to kick on, you know, for everyone just to get better, whether it's the batters, the spinners. I was so impressed with those young spinners. Mm. And then I think now the next move is in bowling. You know, we've had a very experienced bowling attack. Inexperienced spinners, batters, none of them were really established by Root and Stokes. And now it's about the bowlers. You know, and we'll have a bit of experience in there, but then we need some more pace. Mm. You know, pace with skill, that's the dream. Mm. You know, and that's where we've got to take, you know, that's the next wave. So anyone out there, don't be telling youngsters to just run up and bowl straight. You know, get rid of this stupid wide rule that you have with under 12s and, you know, where you're just penalising kids so much for wides. Just get them to run in and let the thing go. And that's the next thing we've got to get right, I think. And that's, you know, that's why it's fun. You know, you can make a few moves and see if it works.
Yeah, pace is exciting, isn't it? I mean, it sounds like we need Jofra Archer back. And, of course, he is sort of gradually getting back to fitness. Exciting prospects there. Actually, Harry Brook, you know, I mean, what an absolutely incredible talent. And what a lovely bloke as well. I mean, you know, to actually give up the whole of the tour because his grandma died and because he's so close to her and his family was amazing. And the fact that you saw that and appreciated that and sort of were kind to him and very tolerant. But actually, I heard a great story about him recently that a friend of mine, a Yorkshireman, just a sort of ordinary guy, his son was 13 and started a little business repairing bats. He quite enjoyed mending a few bats. And he posted online on Instagram. He said, you know, anyone who fancies having their bats repaired, give me a text. And he got a call from a voice who said, I'd like some bats repaired. And so, and his dad took the call. And so he said, well, okay, who is this? And the chap said, it's Harry Brook. And he said, no, you have me on. No, it was actually Harry Brook. And Harry Brook, the next morning, 7 a.m., came round to the house, gave about six of his Grey Nichols bats to this 13-year-old boy to repair, and he repaired them, and now he's using them for Yorkshire. I mean, just a beautiful story about Harry, isn't it?
He's one of the great lads. He got his first 100 in Pakistan, and he was batting with Stokes, and he's very dry, Brookie. Like, he's one of, I think we massively, I sound like I'm lecturing, and I'm really sorry about, like, I feel like we put so much importance on academic intelligence, like at school with kids. There's so many different forms
that's
of
intelligence. That's just because you failed your A-levels.
Well, that's true, yeah. And I didn't do A-levels. I was only GCSEs. But Brookie's very, like, sharp. And when he got his first 100, he barely celebrated. You know, like people do the big fist pump and the jump. And Stokes, he's sort of running up to him to give him a massive cuddle, and he's just, like, one hand up. And he just says, Stokes, you're not going to celebrate. He goes, I don't do that shit. Apologise for my language. And then Stokes plays, it's a flat pitch, but Stokes plays and misses it a couple of balls. And Brookie walks down to him at the end of the over and says, what did they do? And he just says, I don't know. And Brookie went, do you not watch the ball? And he just, like, he's just so dry.
Yeah.
I mean, I was sort of singing once in the dressing room. I don't know, I'm sort of humming to myself. And he's like, who's that? And I said, oh, Adele. And he went, keep it that way.
yeah, brilliant. His most exciting moment last year, he said to me, was not hitting 80 not out to win the Ashes test or 100 here or there or anywhere. Or hitting fantastic, he hit an incredible 100 in the 100, didn't he? Like 50 balls or something. He said, no. His favourite moment of summer was bowling a maiden to Steve Smith. Because they told him on the golf trip to, where was it, Loch Lomond or something, all the Ashes. They said to him, Stokes said to him, if Steve Smith comes in, you're on. Brookie, you're on, you're bowling. And he was, didn't he? He came on, didn't he? And he bowled him a maiden. And Brookie, that was the highlight of his Ashes, I think.
Yeah, it would be. He's a beauty. But that, mate, you talk about the golf trip and stuff like that. McCullum has one thing, and I reckon it's bloody good. You know, I remember him saying once, like, you should enjoy it, and this is where you go back to what we try and do and all of that. And he has one thing. He says, like, and I think this is such a good way to live your life. He said, you should enjoy your career while you're doing it. You should enjoy the job you're doing while you're doing it. You know, not look back on it and think, oh, that was great. You know, like you're saying, you know, I spent a lot of my career going like, oh, I could do about today. Opening up the curtains, hoping for rain, then I could play cards and, you know, all this stuff. And I hated fielding. But then I had a great job. And actually what we try and do is make it, because there's so much noise, so much scrutiny, there's people writing and talking about you all the time. You forget, actually, this is fun. There's that sort of view that you should enjoy your job or your career whilst you're doing it, not look back in 10 years and think that was all right. And I think that's a great way to actually try, for anyone to try and do something.
So that's Rob Key. What are we to pick out from that, yours, do you think? I mean, the emphasis on fast bowling. Fast bowling is absolutely the key. I mean, you know, county bowlers have been trying to work with this Kookaburra ball in the first two rounds of matches. The pitch has been, you know, reasonably flat, and the ball has been, well, even flatter, if you like, and they've struggled. Is pace is the way? Is that the key?
Yeah, I mean, we talked actually about, we funnily enough, we made a list of the great fast bowlers of the game. When we were sat on the table before we spoke, and we were kind of categorising great bowlers and putting them into lists, and we sort of came up with who are the great bowlers of the modern game, fast bowlers, and we came up with, he actually came up with Cummins, Bumrah and Rabada, interestingly, and obviously Broad and Anderson are in there as well, but the thing that characterises those three, Bumrah, Cummins and Rabada, is pace. And also skill, but they're all of high pace. They can generate that sort of 88 to 90 miles an hour. So that's what we're looking for, I think, as an England setup, to have that available in all formats. And therefore, he's going around the country looking out for people who have genuine pace. He mentioned Josh Tongue. He mentioned Gus Atkinson, of course. He mentioned a couple of new young bowlers who've just come on the scene, who haven't played many games. But, of course, the thing about England now is they don't mind about the experience and long careers. They want to snatch people, pluck people who look as if they've got the potential. And I like that attitude. You know, I think give youth its head and have a go. Give people a chance. Even though they haven't done the hard yards in county cricket, doesn't mean you don't get in having done the hard yards, but it's a sort of stimulating option there. It's something that it's encouraging people to go for it, really. So I think I'd pick out that, and just his general optimistic view of life, actually. Take a challenge on, give it everything, and if it doesn't work out, okay, you tried your best. But grasp the opportunity and don't be scared of doing something new. You know, he said that about taking on the job, really. He'd never sort of worn a suit or had a proper real job before. But he thought, well, I'll give it a go and see what I've got. And I think he's done a pretty good job, actually. I mean, he says that they could have won in India. I might slightly take issue with that. But they were competitive in several of the test matches, in a tough place to win. But now, you know, it's they've got to move on from a rather disappointing winter. And he accepts that.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things, isn't it, really? You look at the England side, I suppose, you know, what's it for? Is it to excite? Is it to win? And, you know, they have excited, I think, the English public. I think, over the 2 years that we've had Brendan McCullum and Ben Stokes together. I suppose ultimately, the thing that they look ahead to, and we always do look ahead to, is Australia, the Ashes. You know, can they go down to Australia and, well, firstly, be competitive, isn't it? I mean, that's the thing. be competitive, because England have not been competitive for over a decade in Australia. Australia haven't won here for 20 years, but they've always been competitive, or largely they've been competitive. England just haven't been competitive in Australia, and that's perhaps the next challenge. And also, can they, you know, get themselves up the table in the World Test Championship? Can they, you know, potentially fight for a place in the final? It looks a bit of a long shot because they've had a difficult winter and a difficult start, you know, in their two series against India and Australia. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, ultimately, you're probably judged by results, aren't you? But is the fun factor also a huge part of it as well? Well, I suppose that's up to the English public to decide that.
Yeah, and actually, I think that is, in a way, that's the tone he sold throughout his chat. And actually, the abiding memory I had of that conversation was how important it is to remember, when you're a professional cricketer, it's fun. It's actually a fun job. It's not a chore to be a cricketer. It's an absolute privilege. And remember about the fun of it, rather than thinking, oh, God, I've got to go out there again and play, and I wish it was raining. Actually, no, embrace the fact that it's a fun job, and you'll look back on your life as a cricketer when you're in your dotage or our age or whatever and think, wow, actually, that was really good fun. But engage with that at the time, and that actually takes the pressure off, and hopefully you can enjoy yourself and be enjoyable to watch.
Here's a question for you, Yoz, then. When you woke up in the morning and you put your curtains back and it was raining, it was a county championship day, do you think good or did you think bad? Do you think good, I got half a day off here, I might have a day off, or do you think bad, I want to play cricket today? Come on, be honest.
It all depended who you were playing against and how many days you'd already had. If you'd had 28 days out of 31 already, you were praying for rain. If you were about to bowl at Graham Hick and Ian Botham for Worcestershire, you were praying for rain. But if you were about to play a very ordinary Yorkshire team, or at a time, actually, Surrey as well, who weren't that good in the 80s, you were actually looking forward to it, thinking of, especially against Yorkshire, you were thinking, I've got some wickets here. So it did depend a little bit who you were playing and how many days previously you'd played. But in the main, I did look forward to it, actually. I it was kind of, you know, what's going to happen today? I always felt that. And that is... it's the luxury that you have, actually, as a professional cricketer. You don't know what's going to happen today. And you've got the chance to make something happen. And that's actually a wonderful opportunity.
Not much fun bowling at the Chinnaswamy Stadium today, Yoz, in the IPL. I think we should just have a look at that very briefly at the end of our podcast. Sunrisers, 287 for 3. RCB, 262 for 7, so Sunrisers winning by 25 runs. And it was the Sunrisers earlier in the IPL who made the highest score ever in a franchise T20 match, and they've gone and broken that record. Travis Head, who's actually looked quite threatening earlier in the tournament, actually done it today and come out with a 39-ball 100, one of the fastest 100s in the IPL. I mean, good luck bowling with the Kookaburra ball, good luck bowling at the Chinnaswamy Stadium, especially against Sunrisers batters.
I just wonder what Rhys Topley thought of all that, because he was 4 overs, 1 for 68, wasn't he? Does he want to? Would he rather be doing that and probably getting paid, you know, a nice little small fortune, or would he rather be playing counter cricket with a Kookaburra ball? I wonder. I think at the moment he'd probably prefer being at the Chinnaswamy Stadium, even though the ball kept getting dispatched over the ropes. So, you know, it's a bit of a mug's game being a bowler, but you look back on it, actually, with pride, even if you did get knocked for 17 and over. So that's it for today. We've had lots of interesting input here. Obviously, a sad day in many ways, but also a very interesting day listening to Rob Key and the purposeful, positive note that he sounds. Don't forget our other podcast as well, the sister podcast, Storylines. I actually commentated with Melissa Story the other day. She's absolutely brilliant and full of beans and very interesting to listen to. So look out for Storylines, our sister podcast, and we'll be back at the weekend. I'm here again for another round of games, watching Hampshire against Warwickshire. We'll report back from that.
Thanks very much for listening. Good luck to all you bowlers out there.
Social Podcast Network.